welcome to the very first Poetry Center at MSU. And my name is Steve Esquith. I'm the acting dean of the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. Great to see you all here. And as you know, we're kicking off the Poetry Center with a series of readings this semester. And our first reading will be from the esteemed, who wears many hats. And one of them is the director of the Poetry Center. And while she wasn't looking, I snuck in the room and put some other hats down. So she is also the coordinator of all the arts programs in the Residential College. She's a professor in the Residential College. She runs programs for many folks in other institutions as well, Ghost Ranch and in West Virginia. She does more than I could have imagined, and I imagine she was doing a lot. And when I said, Anita, how about a Poetry Center? Wait a minute. And she said, how about a Poetry Center? It wasn't my idea. When she said, how about a Poetry Center? I said, that's great. You'll do it, right? And she said, of course. And so she's doing it. And she's also enlisted folks from all over campus to work with us. So it's not a little cocoon inside a slightly bigger cocoon of the Residential College. And Anita will say more about who the other folks are who are working with her. I just want to mention that in this series, we'll have Gordon Henry and Diane McCoskey, who will be doing readings this semester, and also a guest poet, Carolyn Forche, who is a graduate of MSU and a poet. So we have a wonderful lineup this semester. And we have a great group of people in the Poetry Center. And we have great support from the Department of English, the Creative Writing Program, and the MSU Press, and the main library. We have the library, and Peter and Martha are here. I want to thank you both for helping us with this. This is a little risky, but I'm going to do next. I'm going to read one of Anita's poems. Because it's instead of saying, Anita did this and Anita did that, you've got a lot of books back there, and in every book there's a different biography of Anita. And so you can choose your book and choose your biography of Anita, and that would be interesting. But there's one poem that's just perfect for tonight, and Anita said she wasn't going to read it, so I'm going to read it. And you'll have to be patient, because, of course, I'm not a poet, so I can't read it like a poet would read it, or like the poet would read it, but she's not going to read it tonight, so I'm going to read it to you. It's called Becoming Haiku, and those of you who know a little bit of haiku, which is what I know, a little bit, it's seasonal, right? It's a seasonal poem, and this is the beginning of a season, we hope, autumn, right? We think it's autumn. And also, it's about a poem. It's about poetry. So it's a poem about poetry for the beginning of the Poetry Center. And it's in autumn. So that's why. And it's a real one. Becoming haiku. How, in October, the world reduces itself to a few syllables. Red leaf, a slick spark, frost, sharp day, I come walking early with the dog. Straining at her leash, nose poking at crystal grass, but nothing shatters. The morning sits still as a room with a secret where I find myself. Shedding everything but my bones and skin, this coat, the shape keeping me. Intact like the red leaf, I break off from the branch, become singular, and begin my inward curl. And welcome, Anita Skeen.
Gosh, gosh, where did all these people come from?
I have to say, I'm very nervous about this. I'm more nervous than I've been for a long time. And I was saying to several people this evening, I think it's because there's so many people out here that I know. And it's much harder to read to people that you know than people that you don't know. So I hope I'll do okay, but I might just turn it over to Steve. he seems to be good at poetry, so I want to say how delighted I am to be here and to be reading tonight and to be part of the Poetry Center. And while I did go to Steve and say, hey, let's have a Poetry Center, it never would have happened without his vision and his belief that people like you would come out tonight to hear poetry in a place like the New Residential College and Michigan State. And I want to thank about five people, six or seven people before I start, because there are some other people without whom this would not have happened either. And those are the students who have helped put this thing together and who have done more work than I can possibly tell you. And I'm going to tell you their names, and I'm going to ask them to stand up so that you can turn around and see who's responsible, really, for this evening. Stephanie Glazier, who's the assistant to the director of the Poetry Center, sitting beside her is Julie O'Connor, who's one of the Castle Fellows, and Van Kalbach, who's the other Castle Fellow who's working with them. The newsletter editor that you'll see back on the back, we now have something called the Sidewalk Press, and Natalie Bainter is the newsletter editor. And Leah Greenwell is my professorial assistant, who has been wonderful with ideas and just relentless in working. And the other two people I owe a great debt of thanks to are Carol Cole and Pam Neustadt, who work in the Royal Office. I mean, in the RACA office. Stand up. Yeah. And thank all of you for everything you've done for tonight. I'm so grateful, I can't tell you. The Canadian poet Bronwyn Wallace, who died several years ago of throat cancer, used to start every reading by reading a poem by a poet who was no longer with us, to bring the presence of that poet into the room, and also to say that we are part of a tradition of poetry. And for those who are no longer with us in body, they are still with us in spirit. And so I wanted to start tonight not with a poem, but with about three paragraphs from a book that many of you will know, and it's Muriel Rukeyser's The Life of Poetry, which was first published in 1949 and is as relevant today, given the times we live in, as it was when it was published. And this is the opening three paragraphs from the book. Think that this was written in 1949. In this moment when we face horizons and conflicts wider than ever before, we want our resources the way of strength. We look again to the human wish, its faiths, the means by which the imagination leads us to surpass ourselves. If there is a feeling that something has been lost, it may be because much has not yet been used. Much is still to be found and begun. Everywhere we are told that our human resources are all to be used, that our civilization itself means the uses of everything it has, the inventions, the histories, every scrap of fact. But there is one kind of knowledge, infinitely precious, time-resistant more than monuments, here to be passed between the generations in any way it may be, never to be used, and that is poetry. It seems to me that we cut ourselves off, that we impoverish ourselves just here. I think that we are ruling out one source of power, one that is precisely what we need. Now, when it is hard to hold for a moment the giant clusters of events and meanings that every day appear, it is time to remember this other kind of knowledge and love, which has forever been a way of reaching complexes of emotion and relationship, the attitude that is like the attitude of science and the other arts today, but with significant and beautiful distinctness from these, the attitude that perhaps might equip our imaginations to deal with our lives, the attitude of poetry. What help is there here? Poetry is, above all, an approach to the truth of feeling. And what is the use of truth? How do we use feeling? How do we use truth? I'm going to read a couple of poems from, old poems from the books that are in the back, and then I'm going to read new poems. And if you've heard these old poems, I hope you like them. And I'm going to read a seasonal poem to start off, too. I really like writing letter poems because I find that sometimes they give you the best of poetry and the best of prose at the same time. And this is an autumn poem. It's called Ghost to Pumpkin, a Letter. So imagine the ghost writing to the pumpkin. I see you there, nested in vines and bedded in leaves. Your autumn orange, a solid statement in a vanishing season. I know about leaves, brilliant and waxed, that flame like demons before age warps them to husks and winds thrash them to dust. Where are their lights now in this gray between season? But there you are, colorfully napping, sturdy enough to thump on, plump as an overgrown persimmon, thoroughly grounded. Do you dream of a gossamer self, able to slip from the knotted grasses, able to rise above your squashed body like steam from a pot? Do you wonder what it's like to be fingered by the wind, to hold the wind, to be the wind? When you are snatched from your patch for the carving, which will happen, will you feel the knife rip your tight-lipped skin? Is this the source of hollow sound? Eyes, nose, teeth that would be an orthodontist's delight. You become the carver's worst fear, the hostess's clever art, the child's lantern. Light will glow in your belly, fire dance in your eyes. How I would like to hold your warmth, your burning, your flame, that for a moment transforms such ordinary night. Horsemen clatter along the boards of memory. The moon ducks behind whipped clouds, pie round and smiling. The other poem I'm going to read from this book, I'm reading because we're starting a program in the book arts here, which I'm very happy about. And I used to be a letterpress printer in one of my former lives. I don't know which biography that's in, but it's in one of them. And I had all these pieces of letterpress equipment in my garage that Beth said, get rid of them. They've been sitting here since we moved 18 years ago, and you haven't done anything with them, which was true. So I decided I would give them to the residential college, and we would have a book arts program. So we're going to do that. But I really loved letterpress printing. I loved the smell of the ink. I loved the texture of the paper. I loved the way words came up and the impression that was made. I loved the print shop late at night when I was the only one there. I can't wait to pass this joy on to other people. And in this book, there are a series of dramatic monologues in which different persona speak. And this is a poem called The Printer Considers Her Artistic Heritage. And I come from a family of women who can do anything and everything, most of which has to do with thread and fabric. And I don't do any of that stuff, so I'll just say that. The printer considers her artistic heritage. In her dotage, my great-grandmother took up needlepoint, planting tiny roses on the footstools, potting bouquets of violets in dainty frames on the wallpapered hall. Her stitches seemed fractions of fractions, 1,000 petals in the needle's eye. My grandmother discovered crochet, eggshell thread spinning webs thicker than spiders' nets, intricate as Queen Anne's lace, crosses for bookmarks, tiny doilies studded with dime store pearls, a hat like a quilted lid I wore through the winters of childhood. And my mother, retiring in Florida, turned the sea's leavings, filled her home with mollusk and conch. Coquinas perch like butterflies on the lid of a clamshell candy dish. Angel wings, abalone, and sand dollar, she tools into necklace and bracelet, pendant and pin, her house a walk-in jewelry box, the chambered nautilus at the end of the block. I, too, needy of art in my middle age, discovered my love. But no slim needles for me, no mini circles the size of a cat's eye, no tissue-thin geometry I can crush with my thumb. I'm learning the letterpress, that clanking flagship of the print shop, that fossil of the book age. 900 pounds of metal clatter in my garage. The back of my truck swamps in foundry type, and the names of the faces roll from my tongue like gospel hymns. Garamond, Helvetica, Century Schoolbook, and Bimbo. No sewing box for me, no microscopic thread. It took two friends and me 3 hours and a hydraulic hoist to raise and lower my press from the bed of the red Toyota, one iron foot clinging in a groove each jerk. I will spend my old age surrounded by wheels and cogs, levers and treadles, feeding reams of rainbow color to this Venus flytrap, which will spit them back at me, imprinted with words and lines, stories my grandmother might have spoken as she sat doing her lap work in the exquisite evening light. I'm going to read two West Virginia poems, which many of you know, that's the place I grew up and the place I still call home, and the place I love more than any place in the world. And when I was in Canada several years ago, I spent the summer living in the Gage Towers at the University of British Columbia when I was doing research for Canadian literature. And I used my window on the 17th floor looked out on English Bay, and I could see all the cruise ships and the barges and the boats going by. It was wonderful. And I kept being drawn to the barges. And I knew that part of that was because of my heritage. And I used to watch the barges push the coal bins up and down the rivers, sometimes 10, 12, 15 at a time. And staying there in Canada and watching those barges really brought back a lot of my past. And I remembered a song. I used to be a camp counselor for years, too. And those of you who've been to camp may know a song called Barges. Out of my window, passing in the night, I can see the barges' flickering light. Silently flows the river to the sea, and the barges, they go quietly. Which is the epigraph for this poem, called Barges. For 11 days, I've watched from my high window the boats on English Bay. They travel on this gray plain from Vancouver to Seattle and Victoria, to Alaska and places I can't name. Sharp sailboats circle like white-finned sharks. Ferries plod along beside them, and cruise ships cut through the water with their steel laughter, haughty in their racks of lifeboats and jazz band playing on the upper deck. But it's the barges I watch for, binoculars skimming over pleasure boats and tankers. What is this romance with the barge? Rectangular bins sunk almost to water level with its weight of lumber and sand, boxes and crates, workhorse among the painted ponies and rodeo mares. When I was a child, I watched the river near my home carry the burden of coal, 6, 7, 8 barges long, the tugs sputtering like it might go under, the fractured heart of my mountain transplanted to another state. No hulls with colored wings, no speedboats pulling skiers, no sternwheeler of gamblers, cards flying before gunshots. Only the barges, steady and dependable, ran the river. Some tangible sadness in their silent passing, north and south. Some sense in me of the life of work, simple and necessary. Now I watch them in another country, sunset streaking by like a comet. As I sit at my desk to write, my cargo of words floated on lines as on a river, the heart blasted and mined into dark, hard rocks, each one capable of fire. I always wanted to write a poem with the word linoleum in it. You know, there's certain words. For a long time, I wanted to write a poem with the word hunker, and I accomplished that, but it took a little longer to do linoleum until I came across a quote by Alice Munro and Tess Gallagher, too, who talked about linoleum. And these are their two quotes, and they serve as epigraphs for the poem, which is just called Linoleum. But Alice Munro said, People's lives in Jubilee, as elsewhere, were dull, simple, amazing, unfathomable, deep caves paved with kitchen linoleum. And then Tess Gallagher wrote, I love this one, overwhelmed by the loneliness of the saints, I take up my broom and begin where I stand, with linoleum. And I grew up in houses and church basements that had a lot of linoleum, and oftentimes it was cracked and peeling, and there's something about linoleum that says home to me. I want to say something about it too, Tess and Alice, about those dull floors of the mountain homes, about the impossible colors mashed into a mixture of cork and linseed spread over a burlap backing, the pea soup green of our 7th Avenue kitchen, the baby turd brown of the church basement, the crab shell salmon in the tiny rooms I rented from Miss Winifred Rue, turquoise and orange triangles on blue sky, mud gray stripes flecked with gold suns, the floors I track on when I step back in time, string mop in hand, cracked, glued down to warped boards, rippling like a stream as it flows through a hallway and three rooms. I'm back in someone's house, someone's great aunt in Kentucky, West Virginia. Something has happened. I can tell from church ladies who bring jello salad and beans, chicken and kale greens, high back chairs rocking their creaky talk in the parlor, my small body cold like this house and low to the ground. But I see linoleum swirling through the rooms, me wading along it, into it, voices high up like birdsong in lamps, on mantel and clock. Then somewhere beyond linoleum, a woman cries. I've got a new little book back there that I'm really happy about that's called When We Say Shelter. And I wrote it with Jane Taylor, who's an Oklahoma poet, who will be coming as one of the visiting artists here for spring semester. And we both have had a long time affiliation with Ghost Ranch, and all the poems in the book, I wouldn't necessarily say are about Ghost Ranch. They're about other things, but they mostly take place at Ghost Ranch. And I'm going to read a couple of those because I know there are people in the audience who have been to Ghost Ranch. And I think the first one is pretty self-explanatory. And also, since I've got a room full of teachers here, this is for all of you. The poem is called The Burrows, and the epigraph is, "The Burrow Ate My Poem," which one of my students, Dorsey Hill, said. At Ghost Ranch, the burros munch on grass and cafeteria apples offered from the hands of writers who've come this week to watch the aspen glow jack-o'-lantern gold and see the silver disc of the moon dot the eye on kitchen mesa. The burros, warily sociable, come to the pasture fence to nuzzle even empty hands. This morning, as we are about to read our poems in class, Dorsey laments a burro ate her poem. In 37 years of teaching, I have never heard this one before. I think of the rock-hard pear I offered yesterday to the ghost-faced burro. How much tastier a pantoum would have been, most certainly a villanelle. He curled his lips as if to ask, "What's this?" crunched the pear, chomped some more, then turned away, not waiting to see if I had dessert. Perhaps that was just before Dorsey ambled by, scratching furiously in her notebook the words choya, paternal, piedra lumbre, chamisa, tempting him back, his long ears tickled by such delicious syllables. Perhaps he couldn't help himself, leaning across the barbed wire as though he wanted only touch, and when in innocence she reached her right hand toward his nose, those yellowed teeth dove deep into her notebook, ripped the page, ingested every word. I think he must have turned, then looked her in the eye, a Mona Lisa smile opening across his burro visage, a grin exactly like the one she gives me now. After I'd done a reading at Ghost Ranch, Jane and I, the last couple of weeks, we did some readings in Oklahoma and New Mexico and Kansas, and somebody came up to me after the reading and said, you know, if all these poems are true, you never sleep at Ghost Ranch. You're up all night walking around. And I said, well, the poems are true. And that's pretty much true, too, because at Ghost Ranch, you're in an area in New Mexico about 60 miles northwest of Santa Fe. And off in the distance, you can see the lights of Los Alamos, but you can't see anything else. And at night, the stars are so close, you could practically put your palm against them. And the longer you walk around in the dark there, it seems to me the lower and lower the stars come. And there's an alfalfa field in the center of the ranch, which often has deer and coyote and various things in it at night. It's about a mile around. And when I can't sleep at night, I walk that circle, but so do a lot of other people. So you're not out there by yourself at all. So this is a poem called Walking in My Pajamas to the Library, Midnight, Ghost Ranch. And you can also walk around in your pajamas there. Nobody cares. The wind asks me where I'm going, but I don't answer. I wear flip-flops, sand from the road scuffed up between my rubber sole and toes, nails painted metallic copper by my cousin last Friday night. The slap, 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 slap says all there is to say. I'm taking Emily Dickinson to her shelf, to the small cubicle of her confinement after releasing her for 3 days in class, letting her bent syntax exhaust us one more time. I think of her wild nights as I walk beneath a Milky Way so bright, so close, I keep ducking my head. A satellite blinks toward Los Alamos, something she couldn't have imagined. Or could she? I'm the only one out, so I stop in the night heat silence, study deer scattered in the alfalfa field. Perhaps I'm the satellite in their night. We orbit each other, as I did today with a silver snake sunning on my flagstone portal. After some tongue talk when I passed by, he settled back into his slithery skin, eyeing me but not oscillating away. Emily spoke his language, I'm sure. Poet of minutiae and circumference, of the universe in a teapot. Overhead, the Big Dipper, stainless steel glinting, prepares to scoop us into night's soup, planets boiling, clusters of stars already simmering. And I hope all of you get a chance to come to Ghost Ranch someday. And I'm happy to talk to anybody about it at length. I finished a manuscript of poems while I was at Virginia Center for the Arts about a year ago, and it's called Never the Whole Story. And right now it's at the MSU Press under consideration, and I hope they'll decide they're going to do it. Maybe reading from it tonight will be good luck. It's divided. I went down there to finish a book called What They Offer Us to Love, but I didn't. I took it apart and put together this other book called Never the Whole Story. And it's arranged. I grew up in a very evangelical Christian tradition, and I left the church for a long, long time and have only recently gone back. But the hymns never left me. And I think if you grew up in a church, in a Christian church, particularly one where singing was important, they never leave you, and they're always there. And in my case, I think it was the hymns that brought me back. I have much disagreement with the church, but I also have much love for parts of it, too. And how this happened, that I ended up writing Never the Whole Story and not What They Offer Us to Love, is that I drove over to Tennessee one weekend to go into the Smokies with a friend of mine who lives in Tennessee. And she said, it was Friday, and she said, you know, all these guys are coming down from the hills up at Husky Branch Friday night in this old elementary school that's been turned into a community center, and they'll be playing their banjos and their fiddles, and you want to go. And I said, you bet. So we wandered around the shopping malls in Gatlinburg, and then we went up into the hills. And when we got up to the center about 6 o'clock in the evening, parking lot was already full. There were cars in the grass. There were people everywhere, people outside tuning up fiddles and guitars and banjos. And when you went inside, it had been an elementary school. And so in one room, there would be a group of musicians doing something. And in another room, there'd be another group of musicians, which I catalog a little bit of in this poem. But down at the end of the hall was the hymn sing. And so I wandered in there with my friend who whose father was a Presbyterian minister, who was married to a Presbyterian minister, whose brother was a Presbyterian minister. And I was surprised she went with me after all that. But we went in and sat down, and that was a profound experience for me in many ways. And when I came out of there, I had a totally different idea for the book I wanted to write. And the book, Never the Whole Story, is divided into five sections, and each of the sections is entitled one of the old hymns. And some of you will know these hymns. The first section is the hymn, I Love to Tell the Story, which is a poem, a collection of poems all about family. The second one you'll know is For the Beauty of the Earth, which is a poems about the natural world and animals. The third section is Love Lifted Me. The fourth section is Let the Lower Lights Be Burning. And the fifth section is Sweet Hour of Prayer. I wouldn't call this a religious book by any means, but I would call it a spiritual book. And so I'm going to read Friday Night Singing at Husky Branch, and then I'm going to read just a couple of poems from each of the five sections. Friday Night Singing at Husky Branch. They've come from all over these hills with their fiddles and banjos, mandolins and guitars, more than the congestion of cars in the grass where we park. Each room in the old elementary school is a mini stage. A 15-year-old piano prodigy in one, a bluegrass band with a female vocalist and an age 7 harmonica player in another, 5 guys synchronizing chords, not saying a word, in a third, and finally, at the end of the still smelling of school days hall, the hymn sing. Church pews where desks used to rest, hymnals on every seat, singers hollering out, 152 now, I said 179, 323. While the woman at the upright piano calls out a key to the men tuning up strings, and off they go. These hymns roll away 50 years, land me smack in the back row of Weekly Memorial Evangelical United Brethren Church, where my mother's in the choir loft giving me that stop whispering to Tommy evil eye, and my daddy's passing the collection plate, and my grandmother sitting across the aisle in her good Sunday dress with the other ladies from the Willing Workers Sunday School class, flapping their Barlow Bonsall funeral home fans with the color pictures of the Last Supper and Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, trying to keep the heat from wilting them like morning glories in the dog day sun. These aren't the unfamiliar hymns sung in German at the Mennonite Church in Kansas I attended when I lived there, or the new inclusive language contemporary rewrites I hear in the church in Santa Fe, where I go when I'm in town. The folks here tonight have come out to rescue the perishing and lift up the drowning through song. They're here to gather at the river, bring in the sheaves, and get over to glory land, you bet. They want to tell the old, old story and stand on the firing line for Jesus. He's as real in their lives as Walmart and Lucky Strike. They take us in, total strangers, though I hear a lady across the way says she thinks we're Methodists, to the fellowship of verse, hymns sung with a fervor I haven't heard since revivals and tent meetings where floors were sawdust, slatted wooden chairs pinched your behind, and summer night breezes prompted my daddy to wrap his coat around me as I napped in his lap. Here the men aren't wearing suits and ties. The women dress in sweatshirts and slacks. But tonight, I could still be in that back pew in my West Virginia past, just as I am, drifting soft and heavy over the shut eyes of the congregation, everyone humming the last verse, the last refrain, waiting for the altar call so we can all go home. Here's another letter poem, which is about my grandmother, and the poem is called Letter to an Unknown and Probably Deceased Photographer. My grandmother died in 1960, and she was 60 years old. It must have been 70 years ago you took that shot. This is to the photographer. It must have been 70 years ago you took that shot. My grandmother standing in front of a car, white wall tire practically up to her waist, running board streamlining the side. A log house backgrounds the car, square logs, good chinking, grounded and going nowhere. My grandmother wears a dress dotted as the Milky Way, a Sunday dress, and a wide straw hat circles her head like the rings of Saturn. She is looking at you with a difficult smile, This woman, who by now had had a husband drown and three daughters arrive, all before her 25th year. I was told she never stood for photos, covering her face with her hands or a scarf, taking the scissors to any shot that took her by surprise, excising her face. How did you do it? You must have been kin. Though back then, who could afford a Kodak? Who that she knew would have owned such a car, such a house? Was this the one time she let you snap the shutter, stood with her anxious hands folded behind her back? Would you remember her now as she was then, if we could talk? I want to believe you were the friend no one believed she had, someone lost to family history. I want you to be the secret she shares only with me. And this is a poem about my father, which is also from that first section. Remembering my father struggling. The first time he ever said he loved me was in the middle of a snowstorm. Carrying my suitcase, he walked me from the house down the long, slick driveway to the gravel road where the Volkswagen Beetle huddled, a blue igloo. I was about to navigate the icy interstate north to grad school, to the life I lived without him. He said it as he stuffed a $20 bill for gas into the unzipped pocket of my parka. Then he turned and climbed the hill. The first time I called him on the phone after they told me about his stroke and tried to understand his so familiar voice, speaking with an accent never his, I stood barefoot in shorts and T-shirt on the cold concrete floor of an artist's studio. Medicinal smells of paint and turpentine, thick as brush strokes on the canvas. Cans on the table filled with brushes fanned like peacock tails. Had there been a blizzard in his head? Zero visibility, his van sliding off some neural highway into an empty field, no one around to pull him out. I start to shake as if I might have been the first one at the scene, though I know a clerk at Walmart probably saved his life. I'm afraid to let him know I can't understand his speech. I try to answer in a general way, a yes, a no, and hope I've got it right. And then I recognize the words from long ago, hear them with as much surprise as I did then, there on the road when bombarding snowflakes filled my eyes. I know the effort saying them requires. And a poem about my mother, which is called Everyday Physics. Matter can neither be created nor destroyed, I learned in college physics class. So where's my mother's missing poundage? Her body, I fear, is moving into mine. Migrating south a generation, it has retired into my skin, liking the somewhat familiar genes. As she grows smaller, thinner, I find my belly rounding, my hips pushing against the fabric of my jeans. She grows more intimate with her bones. Her clothes remind us she will be leaving soon, has already begun the process, inch by inch, pound by pound. It's happened slowly, no mass exodus, mother to daughter, but an inch in April, perhaps a pound in June. My mother grows lighter, simpler. Some of her memory travels too, but being more ephemeral, it's harder to track down. It hasn't come my way, though it may have encouraged some of my more recent thought to tag along. Having no daughter of my own, where, in a few years, will these accumulations go? Will some stranger awake one morning, feeling burdened, thinking it's only job malaise, unaware when she snaps her waistband, it's become a bit too tight? Those of you who know me too know I love animals, and right now we have three cats, and I love these cats, but they do not seem to love the woodland creatures, which is a cause of great distress to me. But this is a little poem called What the Cat Brought Home. Here outside the front door at 4 a.m., here outside the front door in 4 a.m. porch light, splayed on its back and gnawed through its heart, the frog I've talked with from our backyard pond, keeper of secrets and reminder that each spring, green things return to life, camouflaged croaker of dark's mystery, proof that those we love do not always love what we do. Every purr has fangs, and gifts can come at terrible cost. It's a little poem called In Praise of Forgetfulness. What if my aunt, from the always brand new moment of her illness, asks me if it's snowing in Michigan 6 times in the first 2 minutes of our weekly call? And what if each time I say, yes, we have half a foot and it's still coming down? What if all of what we can't remember floats in our snow globe brains like downy flickerings, drifting to a new terrain each time our world's turned upside down? If I don't find the car keys, possibly it's time to walk. If I lose the digits in your phone number, perhaps a letter should go in the mail. I remember the little lady in the care home who, when I forgot her name and apologized for doing so, laughed and touched her fingertips to her cheeks as if to test if she were really there, then said, I shouldn't worry, since often she can't remember who she is or was. When the time comes that you're a stranger to me every day, let me love meeting you each time with that same leap of heart and hope of what's ahead that I remember. I praise the music, praise the coming storm. I got an opportunity to meet and know a little bit the composer, the pianist Andre Watts, because his wife has come to Ghost Ranch many times, and some of you Ghost Ranch people may know her too, and a couple of times Andre has come with her. And he had a blood clot to the brain several years ago, which he did survive, but he was just about to give a concert out in L.A. when it happened, and I heard about it and wrote this poem as I thought about what that must have been like. It's called The Return for Andre Watts. Could it have been the William Tell you heard the night the blood clot exploded through your veins, a cannonball targeting your brain, knocking you flat? Or was it the mad Beethoven pounding as if he needed sound to breathe, not air? I imagine what chords I might have heard, raised on hymns, not sonatas or symphonies. The revival tent swelling with love lifted me, voices by the river offering power in the blood. Onward Christian soldiers concluding the funeral of a good friend. Could it have been Wagner setting ablaze the Nordic night you heard, keys burning like white torches? Your wife writes that you are home, sleeping now, borne across the country in 3 hours' time. She says your first gesture upon return was to touch the piano. Brahms, she writes. I see you fit your fingers to the keys the way, after near disaster, we touch the face we love, hardly believing we could be so lucky, still together in this same life. And the last one I'm going to read from that manuscript is a little poem called Elegy for Wings. On the gravel path this morning, I saw a butterfly shudder, then realized I witnessed a single wing, detached, lifted by the wind, lowered by the wind. I pinched it gently, as though the creature who wore it once was still attached, so thin, a slice of silky geode. Even in dull light it shimmered, deep blue-black, veined like a leaf, tips of silver blue with crescent moons, comets of orange and one orange sun. Where did it voyage without its boat? Where is its twin, the other flap of flight? Where are such wings that could lift my weight? And then I'm going to end up with a few poems from a manuscript that I'm working on now, which there's an old song that some of you may know, which was made popular, I think, by June Carter, before she became June Carter Cash. And it's a song about when the pioneers, and particularly Daniel Boone, crossed over from West Virginia and Virginia, although it was all Virginia then, but when they crossed from Virginia into Tennessee and into Kentucky, they went through the Cumberland Gap, and they also went through an area called Moccasin Gap. And Moccasin Gap was a pretty dangerous place because the Indians, of course, didn't want them coming and often got them when they came through Moccasin Gap. And there's a, I think the song is called Moccasin Gap, but the chorus says that the pioneers are on the road down troublesome, the road to Moccasin Gap. And I've always loved that phrase, the road down troublesome. So I stole that, and I'm using it as the title of this new collection that I'm working on. I think a lot of us are on the road down troublesome a lot of the time, both personally and, it seems to me, nationally in some ways now. And I want to read, there's a series of poems in this collection that are letter poems, again from, they're sort of dramatic monologues in the voices of people who are not me. And I'm going to read a couple of those poems. And all of the titles are from so-and-so, from the dreamer, from the painter. And this one is called From the Former Soldier, Remembering. It's not like I planned to fight. When the war came along, I had to swap my fiddle for a rifle. Didn't have a choice. I don't mind saying I was scared, petrified, frozen inside like a stone, a tombstone. I heard the chisel chipping letters every night. I figured when my name was done, so was I. I don't mind saying I cried. When I couldn't take the uproar anymore, the mortars, the screams, I'd think about the fiddle tunes. I'd think about how the bow felt in my hand, loose and lazy, not cold and metal and tight, not like a gun. And how sometimes the bullets zinged by like the bow across the strings when I was warming up, before the music started to find its way through the scratching. But the music never came. I'd think of the fracas of feet on the wide planks, how the parlor floor tilted so sometimes you slid south about the time you reached for your partner's hand. I'd think about those small hands, the gal's hands, soft as the boy's belly accepting the bayonet, the same small cry. And this one is called From the Suicide About to Jump. For Easter, I wanted a nest of dark chocolate bunnies, their bitter bite more satisfying than the sweet milk chocolate ones. And walking home after babysitting, coming across the hills in darkness, sometimes without a light, but with an orange transistor radio grafted to my ear, I slipped into the night like another skin. Even now, I prefer the striated gloom of uncertain weather to the sun's intrusive light. I resolved to wear black when I passed the half-century mark, surprising myself after all these years of watery shades. I've even taken to rising early, long before the light, to begin my day in shadow where everything is singular, each object uncomplicated by the next. I prefer the black word on the white page to conversation, the world created in text, the aftermath to the anguish of authoring as I go. I choose black granite for my stone. In darkness, all things are equal. The river is a road. And three more, I think, and then I'll finish. This one is called What I Learned in Spanish Class. Imagine a cold day in November. Imagine a too warm classroom in a high school. Imagine 30 students bored with reciting, Buenos dias, Señora Hark, ¿cuál es la fecha? ¿Cómo se llama? Me llama Anita, me llama Carolina, me llama Tomás. Imagine it is the day before Thanksgiving vacation, the final period of the day, and Señora Hark is lecturing us on our slovenly ways, our pre-holiday mentality, our already absent brains. Imagine the voice of Mr. Plimel breaking into the room from the squawk box high on the wall. Imagine he reports that the president has been shot. that he has been taken to a hospital in Dallas, that that's all he knows. Imagine that he tells us to continue our class. Imagine Senora Hark not pointing to a sentence on the blackboard, not correcting the pronunciation of escuela, not requiring that Diego leave the room until he can stop laughing, not referring us to page 142. Imagine silence in room 104. Imagine no collective rolling of the R's, no lecture on proper tongue-to-teeth position, no ducking of the head and studying the carvings on the desk as Senora Hark selects her next victim. Imagine no sigh of relief when it is not you, when it is no one, when Senora Hark does not return to the translation. Imagine 30 minutes you cannot remember until Mr. Plymel's voice reasserts itself through the speaker to tell us it is reported that the president is dead. Imagine Senora Hark, her cheek laid flat against her wooden desk, weeping. And this is another letter poem. There are a number of letter poems in The Road Down Troublesome, and one section is a series of letters to my grandmother about my parents. And this is called Request. I'm out of practice in this art. I write to you from a place you've never been, the red rocks and star-strewn night of Ghost Ranch. You are in a place I've never been, the mysterious dimension of the hereafter, a place where I hope the mail arrives as an instant message and postage is not required. The sprinklers fire like liquid strobes across the alfalfa field. The burros, gleeful in their morning escape through the fence, have been returned to pasture. The afternoon lies back in the Adirondack chairs under the great clouds of cottonwood and dream of the geologic ages. I sit in one of these chairs, content to listen to muffled conversation on the walkway and the wrens announcing their new address under the eaves. It's August, the heavy-limbed month, the exhausted caretaker of summer fun, the lugubrious guest about to return home, north to the state where your young husband drowned, where I live far from the mountains I love, far from the granite stone carved with your names. In 3 days, I will drive the roads east. For 3 days, I will float toward the Great Lakes. In 3 months, I will drive again, this time south, to the place where our lives lie hinged, where your daughter, my mother, slips deeper into her own dimension, my father desperate to delay her departure. She grows leaner each day, her needs more Spartan. She is preparing to slip through the floorboards of this life, to be swept with the dust through the door, to rise with the breeze departing the lanai. She is charting her course toward you. I am asking you to be ready, to be joyful when she arrives. I am asking you to help me solve the equation of loss, to hang grief like laundry on the line, letting the sunshine brighten the cloth. I want to bury my face in its bleached weave. I want to fill the basket with each collar and cuff, to carry it inside, to fold it, and to put it away. And I'm going to end on an uplifting note. There are some happy poems in Road Down Troublesome. I'll tell you that. It just seems they didn't appear tonight. I thought about starting the reading with this or ending the reading with this, and I decided I'd better end it. It's called Apology to Language. I apologize to language for the way I have worn it thin, to certain words for my unhealthy attachment to them, and to others for my premeditated avoidance of them, and to still others for my distortion of them in the mirror I call the poem. I want to apologize to adjectives I have not taken seriously and to adverbs I have tossed out with the trash, believing them spoiled. I have overworked the simile, stretched metaphor beyond all reason. Too often I separated nouns from their verbs with the meddlesome comma, leaving each bereft. I have shouted down the exclamation point, banning it from serious verse. and items in a series. I have strung them out, led them on, gathered them in a group, lined them up for the firing squad of revision. I would apologize to the odd ingredients I stirred in vocabulary soup, causing those who sampled it to blink wide or choke or need several strong drinks. I have spiced it with vernacular, been frugal with jargon, venerated the Latin root. Forgive me, I've never followed the recipe. Thank you.
Something about the haiku.
Oh, yes, yeah. Please. Since Steve read the haiku poem, he gave me an entree into saying that next week, as part of Walking Week, which was several weeks ago, but my walk got canceled because it was pouring the rain down, I'm doing a haiku hike. And if you would like to go on the haiku hike, meet Tuesday at noon at Beaumont Tower. And see, I really am nervous. Beaumont Tower, where there's the bell. And we're going to go to five places on campus. We're going to have a 7-minute haiku lesson. Then we're going to go to five places on campus and write a haiku. And all that in an hour. So if you want to try your hand at haiku, let me know. Thanks. And there are refreshments and T-shirts and books and all that. Please... enjoy. And come back next week for Gordon Henry.